Chamberlain. Okay, so Neville Chamberlain is Prime Minister before the war in the 1930s. So I'm going to start by talking a little bit about him. Now, the Prime Ministers are, of course, important figures in history, but they can't do anything they want. If there's an economic crisis, the economic crisis decides a lot of things, and the Prime Minister has a little bit of freedom, but not so much. So let's have a look at Arthur Neville Chamberlain. He was Prime Minister in 1937 to 1940. So he was Prime Minister at the beginning of the war. And he was from the Conservative Party. Before the war, he was a minister, the Chancellor of the Exchequer. How do you say Chancellor of the Exchequer in French? Yes, absolutely, yes. Just talk a bit louder. I'm old, you know, I don't have a lot of hearing. Yes, that's absolutely correct. And he has generally been criticised for being very slow in understanding the conflict with Germany. Most famously, in 1938, he went to Munich and he met Hitler. And you can see film, I'll try to put the film on the blog, when he comes back to Britain with a piece of paper signed by Hitler. And at the airport, he talks to the journalist and he says, "This is peace in our time. This is an agreement with Mr. Hitler. There is no longer any danger of war. This represents peace in our time." This is so it's a little unfortunate for Chamberlain, because this is the only thing people remember about Chamberlain, which was obviously not his finest hour. But there was a reason for all this, or a few reasons for all this. First of all, the First World War finished in 1918. 1939 is 21 years later. The public opinion was not happy at all about the idea of another war. The First World War was worse in France than in Britain, but even in Britain you had 800,000 killed, a terrible, terrible trauma. And so the public were hoping that it was not going to be, that there was not going to be another war. And even a section of the elite thought, we can't have a war, the people will not agree. Yeah? We will find ourselves with a revolution. Remember, at this time in Spain, there has been a fascist rebellion and a civil war going on. In France, 1936, the Front Populaire, it's not a revolution, but mass strikes, mass social uprising. The British elites were rather nervous. They wanted to be sure about what the situation was going to be. And finally, a small but significant section of the elite in Britain thought fascism was quite a good idea. Remember, the attitudes to fascism before Hitler were much more varied. And just like in France, there was also a section of the elite, yeah, who were not so anti-fascist. So these are some of the reasons that Chamberlain believed Hitler and was confident until the declaration of war in 1939. He declared war on Germany on the 3rd of September 1939, and was generally very much criticised, because the first months of the war saw the attempts of the British forces to take Norway back from the German forces. They were not successful, Chamberlain resigned as Prime Minister and was replaced by Winston Churchill, who, of course, is much more famous. Winston Churchill, very unusual choice, quite an old man, retired, had a very up-and-down political career. If Winston Churchill had died in 1939, he would have been remembered as a bit of a failure. A minister in the First World War, and he was responsible for organising the attack in Turkey on the Dardanelles. It was a disaster. It was his idea. It was a disaster. And after that, in the 1920s, nobody wanted Winston Churchill as a political friend. He was also a great admirer of Mussolini. So in the 30s, it didn't look good, and yet he had some advantages. It also has to be said that he was very much a conservative man. I think it's fair to say, extremely talented. Extremely talented. If you're in politics, you would be happy to have Winston Churchill on your side. He was good. He was extremely organised. Even when he was not a minister, every day he would write notes to the different ministers. Why don't you try this? I think you should do this. He believed that he was very important, and he certainly had an extremely powerful brain. He was also very funny, and I have a couple of examples. What he said about history, he said, history will be kind to me because I intend to write it. L'histoire va me traiter bien parce que c'est moi qui vais l'écrire. Okay, so a real confident ruling class man. He's also said to have been, another couple of examples, they may be true, they may not be true, but they're funny. Apparently, a lady once said to him, sir, if you were my husband, I would put poison in your tea. And Churchill said, madam, if you were my wife, I would drink it. Yes, that's a very, very funny man. Just have one more. Apparently, a lady once says to Winston Churchill, Mr. Churchill, you are drunk. He says, yes, and you are ugly, but tomorrow morning I will no longer be drunk. Yeah, so, very, very funny man, very, very fast man. Yes, it's powerful stuff. So, he was out of office. He was not a minister from 1929 to 1939, so 10 years. He was in the desert, really, and he was best known for things which we probably would not be proud of today. For example, he detested Gandhi, and he wrote a series of, really, the word is racist, articles about Gandhi. You can't call them anything else, yeah? I absolutely detested Gandhi and wanted India to remain British. However, what is important about Churchill is that he considered that the conflict between Britain and Germany was inevitable. And so for all of the 30s, he said, there will be a big conflict with Germany. We need to prepare. And he was really almost the only person saying this. And this is one of the reasons that he was made Prime Minister in 1940. He was also extremely determined. There was no question for Winston Churchill of surrendering. He had a plan. He had plans for everything. If Germany invades Britain, we have our government in exile in New York, no problem. There was no question of... He had a plan ready, because there was a point when Germany nearly invaded Britain, and Churchill was ready to go with the government to New York, government in exile, etc. So he was really... He had a plan, and he was very determined to run with it. And certainly he understood that the only possible winner of the Second World War was the United States. And the reason for this is that a modern war is an economic conflict. Come in. Don't come in then. Entrez. Okay. He understood that economy is extremely important in a modern war. You need to have more soldiers than the other. More soldiers, more weapons, more ships, more tanks. And more soldiers means more food. So the economic side, the economic power of the United States was going to be decisive. And the only chance which Germany had, in my opinion, is if they won before America came into the war. Yeah. Because the once America came into the war, it was just a matter of time. Because they had more of everything. So, Churchill used a new method of trying to make people enthusiastic for the war. One of the things about modern wars is that you need all of the population to agree or to believe it to some extent. And so Churchill worked very hard on the radio broadcast, famous radio broadcast by Churchill. And of course, famously, he said, I have nothing to offer you but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. Very, very interesting. in the First World War, at the beginning of the First World War, they said, war is glorious. War is heroic. You will follow the glorious tradition of your fatherland to win the war. In the Second World War, they said, we have nothing to promise you but blood, toil, tears and sweat. It was no longer possible to say these ridiculous things about how glorious war was. It was nobody believed it anymore. So let's have a look at the development of the war, the first part of the war, what was happening. The Second World War is rather special. If you talk to ordinary people today about the First World War, nobody defends the First World War. Nobody says, the First World War, that was a good idea. I'm very happy that we decided to have the First World War. Great idea. No, nobody defends it, really. That's not quite true. A small group of historians today defend. But it's generally considered to be, you know, a pretty horrible and stupid thing. However, the Second World War is much more complicated, and probably the general attitude in Britain was it was unfortunately necessary. That's probably the general attitude. And this, of course, is because of the very specifically horrible nature of fascism. And certainly anti-fascism was very, very important to the British people's attitude to the war. However, it's very difficult to maintain that the British actions in the Second World War were opposed to fascism. First of all, Hitler becomes the Chancellor of Germany in 1933, and economic links between England and Germany are wonderfully well, no problem, everything is fine. And so suddenly in 1939, it doesn't have an anti-fascist logic. And certainly the British government, for example, did not support the Republicans against the Spanish fascists. A second element of democracy is that many parts of the empire, India, Australia, Canada, were joined the war because the government in London said, you are at war with Germany. And hundreds of thousands of Indians went to war. The Indian Parliament did not discuss it or vote on it. And so, obviously, a war for democracy, well, it's not too easy to maintain. It can't really be said that it was a war to defend Poland. Of course, the beginning of the war was when Hitler invaded Poland. And at the end of the war, Poland was given to Stalin. It's probably better, I agree. But it's not really democracy and freedom for the Poles either. So some difficulties with this. Furthermore, the fascist dictatorship in Portugal, Salazar, was an ally of Britain. Franco, of course, stayed in power after the war. So let's say that the official story of the Second World War is a little bit shaky. Spain wasn't actually in the war. Exactly. Yeah, let's say that if the British were, the British and their allies were most interested in democracy across Europe, maybe they should have brought Franco into the war, yes. No, there is no simple explanation either, that's for sure. But the official story is a little bit shaky. You see a particular version of the official story of the British in the Second World War in British films about the war. And our British films about the war are wonderful. The Russians do nothing. The French resistance does not exist. And the Americans arrived too late. And in the British films about the Second World War, the British win the war against the nasty Germans, and it's wonderful. It's when everything is perfect, yeah? And the Americans, the French are too stupid to fight, and the Russians, well, we don't know where they are. Whereas, of course, I'm sure you remember, the Russians lost many, many millions more than the British. So there we go. What was the situation of the British elite at the beginning of the war? Well, Britain was getting weaker. After the First World War, the British were victorious in the First World War and got quite a number of new colonies. The empire was bigger in 1918, the biggest point of the empire is 1918, but really Britain was not powerful enough to be such a big player. So, for example, in the 1920s, the British government was obliged to leave the gold standard. Ils étaient obligés de abandonner. Donc, qu'est-ce qu'on dit, l'état or? They had to. I'm not sure how you say it. C'est l'étalon or, je crois. Abandonner l'étalon or. Ça veut dire que l'argent n'est plus convertible en or. In the 1920s. C'est tout ce que j'ai là. Il y a une date précise, mais je ne l'ai pas. Really, what this means is that during the 1920s and the 1930s, the British were obliged to recognise that the dollar was more important than the pound. So you have a sort of very slow decline where the British, who were the greatest empire in the history of the world, and they are slowly going down. They tried to, in the 1930s, the British elite abandoned free trade and tried to establish a system of imperial preference, which means India and Australia are obliged to sell to Britain first. To use the political empire to help the economy. The Americans did not like this, of course. As you can imagine, the Americans did not like this. And in fact, the American government had informal links with Gandhi and the nationalist movement in India. So there was tension between Britain and America. And the war would make Britain dependent on America. Not 100% dependent, but fundamentally the junior partner. Because America would give the soldiers and the money, especially the money, to win the war. And after that, the British elite understood very slowly, the British are not very quick at understanding things, that America is number one, and that's the end of the story. I'm going to see if it's possible to teach sitting down just for a moment. I don't know if I can do this. I've never really tried, but you look like patient people, so I'll try it. Meanwhile, in Germany, a terrible economic crisis produced millions of unemployed. The middle class lost all their savings because the inflation. You've seen the stories, yes, that what you could buy with 1 mark and then next week it's 500 marks. Inflation completely rampaged. And the result was that Hitler was able to form a mass movement of desperate people. And the result was this very new phenomenon to history, Nazism, probably the worst thing that history has produced. I think it's a very good option. So the beginning of the war, the German army invades Czechoslovakia in March. And the British say, well, okay, we can accept that. And the German army invades Poland in September. And that is when the British... Yes. Czechoslovakia. Shall I do that again slowly? Yeah. Czech. Oslovakia. Yeah, why not? Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler sign an agreement in 1939. In Poland, the Jewish population is imprisoned in the ghettos, and Britain declares war on Germany. The first part of the war, in French you call it the drôle de guerre, and in English the phony war, phoney, because nothing much happened. The war was declared, but nobody attacked for a few months. Nevertheless, Britain began to prepare for war. All over Britain, they installed balloons. Des montgolfières, to make it more difficult for the aeroplanes. All of the pillar boxes, the post boxes, were painted yellow with a special paint which is sensitive to gas. Perhaps you remember in the First World War, gas, poison gas, was one of the most horrible weapons. And everybody imagined that the Second World War would involve a lot of gas bombs. In fact, it did not. Everybody had to carry a gas mask everywhere. When my mother was 6 years old, and she had to go to school with a gas mask. They thought it was funny for a while. The gas didn't come. It was all taken very seriously. If you went to the cinema, which was very, very important, the cinema, you can't come in without a gas mask. That's very serious preparations. The public buildings were protected with sandbags. In London Zoo, they killed all the poisonous snakes. Yeah? Because they thought, if there's a bomb and the snakes escape, so on. And in particular... Sorry, question?
What's the matter with yellow
bugs
and the...
Oh, yeah, they painted them with a special paint which is sensitive to gas. It changes colour if there is poison gas. So you can... Yeah, why not, yeah? So, yeah to protect against gas, to sound an alarm if there is gas around. Okay. Two very important things. First of all, there was a big boom in weddings. Everybody wanted to get married before the man joined the army. Now, isn't that sweet? Isn't that sweet? The situation very different from the First World War. At the beginning of the First World War, the only people who joined the army were volunteers. Conscription was considered to be not British, not part of the tradition. The left wing didn't want conscription because they said it's against freedom. The right wing didn't want conscription because they said if you have conscription, you'll get bad soldiers. And only after two years of war did they introduce conscription in Britain, with a lot of opposition. But in the Second World War, conscription arrived at the beginning, just like in France in the First World War. So conscription was brought up. And in particular, in September, 1 million children and 500,000 pregnant women were evacuated from the towns. They understood that bombing was going to be very important. And they said, we don't want any children in London. We don't want any children in Manchester, Leeds, the big cities. And so you had evacuation. My mother was evacuated. My father was evacuated. People are sometimes evacuated to their family or otherwise bureaucratically. Yeah, they arrive with a bus of children in a village, knock on the door. How many rooms do you have? 3 rooms. Here's 2 children. Yeah, you don't have a choice. It's war. Yeah. So evacuation, quite traumatic for the children. En plus, c'était pas non plus la même société aujourd'hui. Alors il y a pas mal de cas où après la guerre, le parent, ils retrouvaient plus le parent parce que le parent ils avaient déménagé, ils avaient 5 enfants avant, ils avaient 6. Et il y a pas mal d'histoires, pas des masses, mais quand même, il y a des centaines d'histoires comme ça. Which is a very different sort of situation. C'est sympa. Merci, maman. Okay. It was also a very important social experiment because, of course, if you go to the small towns and you say, who has an extra room? It's the middle class. And who lives in the towns and he's moved out? The working class children. So you had a lot of poor children going into the houses of people who are not so poor, and everybody learnt a lot. There is always a good side even to war. People learnt a lot of things in the war. And this is probably one of the reasons that made it possible after the war to get mass support for the welfare state. The fact that different levels of society said, it was very frequent for middle class people to say, I didn't realise the people in the towns were so poor because when they arrived. There are lots of interesting stories about that. So what other preparations were going on? Well, the Air Force dropped political leaflets on Germany. 12 million. They dropped 12 million leaflets on Germany. So they found somebody who could speak German. They established in Britain the Women's Land Army. So they learned from the experience of the First World War. and they established the Women's Land Army, that is to say that women were going to work in the farms while the men went into the army. I knew an old lady who was in the Land Army, and 2 million men aged 20 to 27 are conscripted to join the army. In February, the Ministry of Information launches a propaganda campaign under the slogan, "Careless talk costs lives." That is to say, be careful, there are German spies about. Don't talk about where your boyfriend is in the army. Don't talk about military matters when people are listening. You know, careless talks cost lives. And also, in March, meat was rationed. So if you wanted to buy some meat, you had to have your card. You can buy 250 grams of meat every week. In March 1940, yes. Very interesting, because in the First World War, rationing began very late, in 1917, 1918. Rationing was introduced for meat in March 1940. Rationing was extremely popular, because in wartime, if you don't have rationing, the prices, of course, there is not so much meat around, because the ships from Argentina cannot arrive, yeah? And so the prices go up. If you have no rationing, only the rich can eat meat. Yeah? So it was actually, rationing is a measure of social justice. It was extremely popular. May 1940, situation in France, terrible situation in France, and the British Army finding itself in a difficult situation in Dunkirk. They evacuate all the soldiers from Dunkirk. 330,000 soldiers are evacuated from Dunkirk, 220,000 British and 120,000 French, as quickly as they can. And it's interesting because the government succeed in presenting this as proof of the great unity and spirit of the British. But one newspaper said, you cannot win wars by running away. So it was not really a victory. Yeah. An evacuation is not a victory. Yeah. And they didn't come back for a long time. Of course, in France, Philippe Pétain signs an agreement with the Germans. And so France is no longer in the war. And this is the worst. This is the worst point from the point of view of the British. This is the worst point of the war. And there is a real question of surrender. Some members of the government, in particular Lord Butler, contacted Hitler's government and said, "Yeah, well, what are the conditions for surrender?" Winston Churchill was not in agreement, but there was this moment when it was not impossible. This is a moment when, after France surrendered, it was close. Well, one of the difficulties about history is that it's always a mistake to think that because something happened, it was inevitable. It wasn't inevitable. It could have happened differently. But in fact, Churchill won the argument with the help of the left wing in the parliament, and the war continued. The British Army had a problem, however, because when they left Dunkirk, they left everything. All the vans, lorries, bombs, tanks, everything they had, they just left away, you know. Prenez votre portefeuille, on y va. N'oubliez pas votre portable. Okay? But otherwise, the equipment, military equipment, Britain had no military equipment left. They had 300,000 soldiers with nothing else. And the solution to this came the following March. Negotiations with the United States for a big loan. Lend-lease, je ne sais pas quel est le qu'est-ce que ça veut dire économiquement, mais Lend-lease, c'est le nom du prêt américain de 1940 qui était massif et qui permet à l'Angleterre de continuer la guerre. Lend-Lease. In March 1941, then the situation was blocked. The Germans decided to attack Britain, and they were almost successful. Preparations were made in Britain to resist invasion. And in July 1940, you have the Battle of Britain. The Battle of Britain is a fight between aeroplanes over the Channel, with the Germans fighting with the British. It was a very, very, very dangerous job to be a pilot. Yeah, I think the average survival was like 3-4 weeks. July 1940. July 10th. Vous n'avez pas besoin de savoir la date exacte. Il y a quelques années, j'avais l'habitude de dire à mes étudiants, oh, ne vous en faites pas trop pour les dates, ce n'est pas l'essentiel. Et je voulais dire, je ne veux pas qu'ils apprennent des listes de dates. Mais le jour où j'ai reçu un devoir où quelqu'un a confondu la Première Guerre mondiale et la Deuxième Guerre mondiale, et puis il m'a répondu, mais vous m'aviez dit que les dates n'étaient pas importantes, j'ai arrêté de dire ça. C'était un peu trop quand même. Okay, so then we have a situation. First of all, the Battle of Britain is won by the British, which is very important because it makes the invasion of Britain impossible for the moment. If you don't have control of the air, you can't invade. Okay. I'm not a military expert. The British won the Battle of Britain fundamentally because they had better radar. The technology was better. The real advantage of the time. And the bombing begins. The Germans begin to bomb the cities of Britain in when? Where's it gone? September. In September 1940, you have the beginnings of the Blitz. And the Blitz lasted for a few months and was extremely traumatic for everybody. My grandmother lived in Manchester during the Blitz, and she never recovered from the Blitz. She became a bit mad, and she never recovered. For 10 years, she didn't leave her house after the war because she just, you know, and she wasn't injured. These are all the hidden victims of war. Yeah, she was just completely... It was too much. It was too much for her. My father was a bit mad as well, actually. I'm the only sane person here. Okay. Okay, so the Blitz. What did they do about the Blitz? First of all, the blackouts. Everybody must black all their windows. The problem is you want... The aim is to make the cities invisible from the sky. So no lighting in the streets... No cars, no lights. You had to black out, and every day an inspector came around saying, "I can see a light through your window. Switch it off." Yeah, so very, very important blackouts. Quite dangerous, actually, people falling over things. Fire watchers stayed up all night. There was always people watching for fires because, of course, these are incendiary bombs which start fires. The government asked people to build shelters in their gardens. On Ipasi or on Yumokata, home front of the Blitz. Anderson shelters. An Anderson shelter is like a hut in the garden. It's not very big. It's not very big. Made out of a metal frame and you put stones and stuff on it. And this is where you go if the bombs arrive. Very interesting, because this was the government preferred this, and it was a long fight. Like, for example, if you live in London and London is being bombed, where is the best place to be? In the metro, in the underground. It's obvious. The government refused to allow to open the underground at night, and after a long campaign mostly organized by the Communist Party, they opened the underground stations. Now, why did they not want to open the underground stations? because they really believed that if people went down, they would not come back up. And they would refuse to go to work. And of course, if people don't work, you can't make the uniforms for the army and the food for the army and the guns. It's impossible to have the war if people stop working. And the government were convinced that if people were allowed to hide underground, they wouldn't come out. So that's an interesting point. You have to remember, there was no experience of huge cities being bombed. So nobody knew what it was like. And in fact, people survived it better than expected. The government imagined, half the population will go mad. That was the official government opinion. And in reality, it wasn't like that. People did manage to survive better than expected. I don't recommend you test it. You know, it's not fun. Yeah. Also, the government planned for 600,000 dead in the first 2 months. Les préparatifs du gouvernement, c'était pour 600 000 morts les premiers 2 mois de bombardement. En fait, après un an et demi de bombardement, il n'y avait que 50 000 morts. Okay, donc, ils exagéraient, un facteur de 10. Mais ils ne savaient pas. They didn't know how it worked. So the government was obliged to allow people into the metro, and they were also obliged to, occupied the basements of the big stores. You know, the big department stores like BHV? The people illegally occupied them. They're saying, you know, we need a shelter, that's a shelter, that's where we're going, and nobody could stop them because there were 5,000 people. And so the government did what they could, but there was a lot of conflict about that. It was very difficult. For example, the underground stations, it was normal to queue. These are English people, so they queue. You know, to queue for 5 hours to get into an underground station for the night. And what you did is you had one person who queued for the whole family. Yeah, and then all the family came at night. So a very, very difficult situation. And of course, some people were honest and united, and some people were not. So people would sell spaces in the underground station. Yeah, there's always people like that. The other thing which happened a lot was what we call trekking. Other option, trekking. C'est pas le trekking. What's trekking? Well, trekking is, for example, if I work in Manchester, after work in Manchester, I walk out of Manchester 10, 15 kilometres to sleep in a field because the bombing is at night. Yeah, the bombing is at night because the aeroplanes don't want to be seen. And then I walk back in the morning. And thousands and thousands and thousands of people did this trekking. The government didn't like it, but there was nothing that they could do about it. 100,000 bombs fell on London in 2 months. 90% of houses in London were damaged. 90% des maisons sont endommagées. Parfois un peu, hein? Parfois beaucoup. And in some cities were completely destroyed. Coventry, in November 1940, Coventry was completely destroyed. And the reaction of the British government was to destroy Dresden and two or three other countries. Dresden is very impressive. Toutes les autres villes autour sont historiques, et on va à Dresden. Tout a été construit. C'est comme Caen, d'ailleurs. Tout a été construit après la guerre. Nothing was destroyed. So this was definitely a very bad situation. In particular, because in the 1930s, there were big campaigns in Britain saying, we never want to bomb cities. Yeah? Say, okay, war can happen, okay, but bombing cities is immoral. We never want to bomb cities. But unfortunately, once the war began, in general, it was quite popular. And the bombings of Germany were carried out in a very public fashion. Winston Churchill went on the radio. It says, yeah, last night we sent 1,000 bombers to Dresden. Yeah, so it was very publicly aggressive. And 300,000 Germans were killed by bombs in Germany. I don't know why there are so many more in Germany than in Britain. Maybe the aeroplanes were better, I don't know. Okay, so chaos. There were no plans. If your house was destroyed, there were no real plans to look after you. Quite a lot of officials were very inefficient. In some towns, you'd find yourself, okay, so where's the chief of police? He has run away. People would just panic and run away and disappear. Yeah, and so things could be in a pretty, pretty bad situation. What else happens? What else happens at this time? Well, rationing and total war. The government understood that if you want to win a modern war, you need to mobilize the entire economy, the entire population. No waste. Everything must go to the war. And they did this in a number of ways. Rationing is obviously one of them. And the other one is utility. What is utility? Well, utility is to try to stop waste. And in particular, clothes. Of course, even in the 1930s, people were beginning to like choosing their own clothes, many different models, etc. And the government said, no, this is wasting money. So from now on, we want the only people who can produce clothes in Britain must produce utility clothes. 5 or 6 different models, no more. Of course, this is much less expensive. So what they did, in fact, is they asked 8 top designers in London to design utility wear for women. And these were produced in mass production, so much cheaper. This was the same with furniture, tables and chairs. Said, okay, only simple tables and chairs, nothing complicated. We need the money for the war. Utility furniture. Petrol, of course, was rationed. And a certain amount of social justice was introduced. For the first time, the income tax on rich people was very high. Donc, les impôts sur le revenu pour les riches étaient très élevés. Ce qui était inconnu avant la Deuxième Guerre, ça reste relativement élevé jusqu'à nos jours. Comparé avec la période d'avant. I think during the First World War, they introduced 5% income tax for the rich. And the rich thought this was terrible. Whereas in the Second World War, you have 30, and in the 80, you know, very high levels later, it became acceptable. Strangely enough, for the poorest people, if you weren't killed, people's lives got better. There was free milk for children, free vitamins for children. Penicillin was used for the first time on a mass scale. So it's a bizarre situation, but in fact, for the very poor, life was better during the war. Because the government, well, first of all, for example, the soldiers, when the soldiers joined the war, the poor soldiers, they were in very bad health. And so the government was obliged to give them good food to make good soldiers. And so that was one important element of it. And medical progress was accelerated by the war. Also, the situation changed very much for women. In 1939, 500,000 women worked full-time. In 1945, 7 million. So in the 1930s, before the war, women did work, but very often part-time work, or very often they would work until they got married. In fact, before the war in Britain, if you were a teacher or a civil servant, you were obliged to stop working if you got married. That was the law. That was the law. You could work until you were married, then you were not allowed to work anymore. So that changed during the war. The situation of women changed a lot. It had already changed in the First World War, and some of the changes remained, but that was an important difference. Let's have a brief look at opposition to the war. Now, just a moment. opposition to the war. Now, of course, it was very difficult for people to be opposed to the war because almost everybody among the ordinary people agreed that fascism was a terrible, terrible thing, and nobody seemed to have another idea to defeat fascism. There was another idea before, of course. If the fascists had lost in Spain, then probably there wouldn't have been a Second World War. And certainly in the 1930s, a lot of people in Britain went to Spain to fight with the Republicans against the fascists. I'm sure you've heard of George Orwell. Yeah, George Orwell, he went to Spain. He wrote a book about it, Homage to Catalonia, very good book about the Spanish Civil War. Many miners in South Wales, many hundreds of thousands of miners went to Spain to fight fascism. If you get to see a film by Ken Loach called Land and Freedom, that's about an Englishman who goes to Spain during the 1930s. Just in case you've forgotten, the Spanish Civil War begins in 1936 when there is a democratic government and a fascist military man tries to carry out a coup d'etat and is not immediately successful. The army of Franco, the fascist leader, occupies the south and the Republic occupies the north, and it's a civil war. 1936, Franco wins. Je vous fond le, je vous explique la fin avant le début. Franco wins and remains dictator in Spain until 1970s.
74.
Thank you. Yeah, 74. Until the 1970s. Yeah, it's quite a long time. Yeah. Okay. So opposition to the war was mostly mostly by pacifists. The most important pacifist organization was the Peace Pledge Union. The Peace Pledge Union is a pacifist organization. It was established in 1934. It was established by a man called Dick Shepherd, who was a priest, who was in the army in the First World War, and after the First World War, he said that, in his opinion, the solution was to reject war and to persuade people to become pacifists. And he established the Peace Pledge Union, very simple pledge, ça veut dire promesse, and if you join the Peace Pledge Union, you sign a document which says, I renounce war and will never support or sanction another. That's a pledge. And their idea was to get the maximum number of people to sign this. The organization still exists today. In the 1930s, they got 100,000 members or so. So it's not a mass movement, but it's a significant organization. Yeah, a mass movement is a million. Yeah, 100,000 is a fair-sized organization. Quite a number of famous people joined it. Vera Brittain, novelist, Aldous Huxley, another novelist, George Lansbury, a socialist leader, for example, and a poet, Siegfried Sassoon, one of the great World War I poems, they all joined it. So it had a number of influential people, and they tried to work against war. They had a problem when the Spanish Civil War arrived, because they were saying, oh, yeah, pacifism is the answer, war is always wrong. And then other people say, oh, yeah, but in Spain, surely we can't be neutral. They're very difficult questions. And the solution for the pacifists was normally, well, yes, we don't want to be outside the conflict. And so they worked very much on helping refugees and other useful work, but which does not involve joining the war. They welcomed many Jews to Britain. For a long period, it was very difficult for Jewish people to come to Britain. When in Germany it became more and more difficult to be a Jew, Britain and America did not really want to help. They were not really interested. and that was pretty difficult. When the preparations for war began in Britain in 1939, the Peace Pledge Union campaigned against. So they had a campaign against gas masks and so on. It was very difficult, yeah, because people were not convinced. But there were 1,000 Peace Pledge Union groups in 1,000 towns around the country. So it was a significant organisation. Some of them were arrested by for giving leaflets to soldiers saying, do not join the war, do not join the war. Yeah, so in wartime, of course, that is not normally accepted. During the Second World War, 60,000 people became conscientious objectors. 60 000 personnes sont devenues des objecteurs de conscience, donc qui ont refusé de rejoindre l'armée. Selon une loi, il existe une loi en Angleterre depuis 1916, que vous avez le droit, si vous pouvez démontrer que vous avez une objection de principe à la guerre, vous pouvez ne pas rejoindre l'armée. Conscientious objectors. Conscientious objectors. 60,000, okay, so that's what I mean. From one point of view, it's not a lot. And compared with what? 6 million soldiers? Yeah, so it's a minority. 6 million soldiers. Yeah. But the Peace Pledge Union continued. For example, they campaigned during the war, they campaigned against bombing cities. They say, you know, it's terrible that the Germans bombed Coventry. This is a terrible crime. But this does not justify destroying Dresden. Yeah? Two crimes is not better than one crime. Yeah? So they're having a campaign about this. Meanwhile, the war continued. Development of the war, part two. Meanwhile, the war continued. The situation was blocked. And the problem was solved from a military point of view. The problem was solved when Hitler decided, I will invade Moscow. Si vous voulez dominer l'Europe, laissez tomber Moscou. Ça n'a jamais marché. Hein? Napoléon, Hitler, ça ne marche pas. Pas la peine. OK, yeah. Sympathizers of Nazism, absolutely. I will talk about that, yes, yeah. During the war, not so many. A handful, a small number. Yeah, of course, some of them very high up, yes. In the 1930s, there were quite a lot of fascists. During the war, not really. A few individuals who were arrested and put in prison, but no significance. Yeah, absolutely, he was arrested. Yeah, but the difference is that Oswald Mosley in 1935, he gave his meetings in a football stadium. Lots of people. But during the war, he was isolated and imprisoned. So there was not significant Nazi sympathies during the war. But before the war, oh yes, there were plenty of them. In fact, we were lucky that they didn't go any further. Yes, so Germany advances on Moscow. Bad idea. Japan attacks the American fleet in Pearl Harbor, 1941. In Warsaw, the Jewish ghetto revolts against the Nazis in 1943. Desperate situation. I think 95% of them are killed during the revolt, but it's a very important revolt. And of course, in 1944, finally, there are the landings in Normandy. Landings. Thank you. Le débarquement. Okay. Donc, vous voyez que je ne vais pas vous donner le détail militaire. Okay. So, once the Normandy landings with a million American soldiers, and a lot of Australians, Canadians, and British. Dresden is destroyed in 1945. Tokyo also destroyed. And in April 1945, Adolf Hitler commits suicide. In May 1945, Germany surrenders. And in August 1945, the United States drops an atom bomb on Hiroshima, and 3 days later on Nagasaki. We got to the end of the war. That was quick. At the end of the war, 360,000 British are dead. 360,000 deaths. And a lot of injured, of course. So, no comparison with Russia. Well, I think it's 12 million or something like that. I don't have, could be 20 million. Yeah, I don't have the numbers yet. You're saying 20 million now. Certainly, no comparison, yeah? No comparison. Yeah? 360,000. It was also something, 360,000. British. Yeah? Don't forget the Scottish and the Welsh. Be careful. Yeah? Okay. Yeah, so 360,000. Still quite a lot. But in particular, financially, it was a very terrible situation. We estimate that 28% of the national wealth was used in the war. They give 28% que de tout ce que possédait la Grande-Bretagne, tous les bâtiments, les chemins de fer, les usines, 28% n'existaient plus après la guerre parce que ça avait été dépensé ou détruit. And so it's a very, very, very big, yeah, very, very big situation. How much did war change society? That's always a very difficult question, very difficult question. Certainly, there was a lot of social mixing. During a war, people meet people from different classes much more. I mentioned the evacuation where the poor children were going to middle-class families, but also in the army, very much a very big social mix which is going on. Also, in the Second World War, the distance between the officers and the soldiers was much smaller than in the First World War. In the First World War, it was very much, you know, the private school were the officers and the state school were the soldiers, and a big, big distinction. In the Second World War, they were obliged to be more democratic. It was not acceptable in the Second World War for the officers to eat wonderful food when the soldiers had very bad food. The officers got a little better, but in the First World War, it was like Downton Abbey, you know, really, that the ordinary soldiers had very bad conditions, and 100 yards away, the officers went to war with their domestic servants. Yeah, it was a very, very huge difference. Of course, the war was very exciting when people are used to having very boring lives. Although war is dangerous, it's also very exciting. The attitude of the governments to the economy changed tremendously. The civil service was multiplied by 3. La fonction publique est trois fois plus grande à la fin de la guerre qu'au début. Because everything is controlled by the government. You see, in a normal situation when there's no war, if I have a factory, what do I produce in my factory? Whatever I want. Whatever I think will make more money by selling. During the war, the government tells me, you must produce, I don't know, tanks or clothes for the soldiers, etc. So the government controls the economy very strictly during the war. This is what we call state capitalism. Now, state capitalism exists in other forms as well. In fascist regimes, the state decides, and in Stalinist regimes also, the state decides what happens. But during the war, all countries became state capitalists. So a big change there. Unemployment disappeared during the war. This is why, for many people, the war was not so bad. In the 1930s, they didn't know how to get food for their children. And in the war, it's dangerous, but on the other hand, my children eat every day. It's not so bad, somehow. Yeah, the poverty and unemployment fell sharply. The other thing which happened is that trade union membership rose very rapidly, l'adhésion au syndicat. In 1947, there are 9 million trade union members, which is much, much bigger. There's a massive, massive rise. This is partly because during the war, the workers realize, oh, we are necessary, so maybe we can have a little more money. Yeah? We are essential to the war. The rich people are not making sacrifices. Maybe we should not make too many sacrifices. Let's have some more money. There was also a tremendous demand for social change. The government had to make big promises. Say, oh, it's very difficult, this war. But if you all fight together for the glory of Britain, after the war, we will not go back to the 1930s and terrible poverty and unemployment. We will see a new world. Yeah. The government was obliged to make promises, and people wanted them. In 1942, I'm sure you remember, was printed the Beveridge Report on Social Security. Report. It is a very boring document. It's a long list of recommendations, very boring to read. They sold 600,000 copies. Okay, quelle est la dernière fois que vous vous êtes acheté un rapport gouvernemental pour lire? Yeah, you see the problem. It was just a government report, but people bought it and read it to their family, and it's going to be completely different after the war. And the most important sentence which we use in connection with the Beveridge Report is "from the cradle to the grave." Du berceau au tombeau. That was the symbol, the protection for everybody from the cradle to the grave. And that was the promise. And actually, to a very large extent, it will come true, which I will explain in a moment. But first of all, before I go on to the next section, I want to say a couple of words about culture. England benefited from a number of Jewish refugees who came to England. Kerslow and Kokoschka, for example. Yeah, I just want to have a little look at what kind of novels were people reading, what kind of art were people... J'ai encore du temps, non? Tout va mieux. C'est fatigant, quand même. Okay. Anybody know anything about this man? Nice name. Yeah. Okay, yeah, he's a novelist, a Jewish novelist, came to live in England and wrote a series of very, very exciting memoirs and novels. Another Jew who came to England, Oscar Kokoschka. Painter, very impressive painter, because he continued producing paintings until he was 96. Yeah, that's a very, very, very impressive German expressionist painter, came to England. And also a great philosopher, Ludwig Wittgenstein, came to live in England at this time. If we look at poetry, we see a big difference in the Second World War. The First World War poets have become very famous in Britain. In general, at the beginning of the war, they wrote about the glory of war. And at the end of the war, they wrote about how horrible, the horrors of war. People like Wilfred Owen, people like Siegfried Sassoon. In the Second World War, the war poets are very different. It is impossible to write glorious poems about war. Nobody believes it anymore. And also, I don't know why, but you don't have the same kind of poem about the horrors of war. The poems are more personal. People like, these are poets, Alan Lewis, Henry Reed. More emotional reactions. Henry Reed, I have put on my blog one of the poems by Henry Reed, a short poem called The Naming of Pots, and it's about being bored and frustrated during military training. A number of other very important writers are producing. Aldous Huxley, English writer. What is his most famous book? Que tout le monde a entendu le titre de son livre le plus célèbre, je suis sûr. Eh oui. Pardon? You might be right, but I can't hear you. Le dernier de quoi? Le dernier quelque chose. Maybe, but I don't think so. Le meilleur des mondes, voilà. Le meilleur des mondes, c'est lui qui l'a écrit. En anglais, ça fait Brave New World. It's about an imaginary future world, which is not so nice. Aldous Huxley, so Brave New World is 1932. And he also wrote in many more books, but the best one is in 1939, After Many a Summer. And those are the writers who are having effect at this time. Okay, well, I have more things to say, but a little pause. Are there any questions? That is the end of the war. There are no more war. Any questions about that? Anything unclear? Okay, so how it works is that you have, you have my class, and then you have some links I put on the blog. Otherwise, I recommend the history book by Peter Clark. Et d'ailleurs, j'ai bien l'impression qu'il y a une dizaine à la bibliothèque universitaire. Je pense qu'on a fait acheter toute une série, je crois. Peter Clark. Et même, j'ai oublié le titre. C'est quelque chose comme la Grande-Bretagne depuis 1900. Hein, donc, la deuxième partie, ce qui nous intéresse. Peter Clark is the best one. Otherwise, any history book is good. But also, les sections des... Il y a Kenneth Morgan. C'est Angleterre 45 à 90, je crois. Ils ont écrit plusieurs livres. Alors, c'est les deux que je recommande plus que les autres. En français, quand même, on a le droit. Roland Marx, c'est vieux, mais c'est encore très, très bon. François Bédarida. Je vous donne plutôt des historiens plutôt que des livres précis, parce que ça dépend lesquels vous... Donc, en français, Bédarida et Marx. Clark and Morgan. Et bien sûr, super recommandé. My favorite historian, Eric Hobsbawm. And he wrote a book on the 20th century called The Age of Extremes, qu'on peut trouver en anglais si possible, mais en français ça a été traduit. Je crois que ça suffit à 5 normes d'historiens. But really, certainly before the end of the semester, you should have read two of these. Because the best way to get a good mark in this thing is to write at exam time something for me where I see, of course, some things I said and also some things I didn't say that you found somewhere else. This makes me so happy. Okay? It's this idea that reading books... One more chance for questions, and then I still continue with the post-war situation. Yeah. Oh yes, good point. Yes, there's a booklet. It is already on sale. It's called Britain since 1945. Yeah. C'est déjà dispo. J'ai vu que c'est affiché. Yes.